6 minutes after 9 o'clock. Good morning and welcome to the Wednesday edition of Eusebius McKayser's show. There's a lot that we have in store for you. Coming up in World of Work after the 11 o'clock news bulletin, in the third and final hour of the show, we asked a question first off with Natasha Moni. What happens when a company appears to go belly up? Wink, Ndalo Media, wink. And what happens to you as the lowly employee? And then after that, we open it for our usual open line with her, which has become extremely popular, and rightly so, because she's an excellent labor lawyer and just an incredible mensch. And ultimately, really, the world of work is fundamentally about psychology and human relations. So something to look forward to after 11 o'clock. Hopefully you're not in a company that is going bust, but in the event that you might be, what are your rights when suddenly the founder is running for the hills? In the middle hour, I hang out with a politician that I love to engage, and that is Tony Leon. He is in Gauteng. I'd asked him to come into the studio. We've had him on the show once or twice. I have, over the years, enjoyed sparring with him. Enormous intellectual respect for Tony. I hope the feeling is at least half mutual. I think it is. And he and his team has rearranged his diary so that he can pop into the 702 studios. And we have him for an entire hour. He's out here campaigning for the Democratic Alliance in Gauteng. And I look forward to speaking to him, not just about the case for the DA, but electoral politics more generally. So that's something to look forward to. Myself and Tony in conversation with each other after the 10 o'clock news bulletin. And of course, as always, you're going to be at the heart of that conversation. You can ask him whatever question you want. I do want him to make the case for the DA, but I also think that he's more than that. I think Tony, in particular, after leaving formal politics as leader of the DA, has been an excellent author, excellent public speaker around the world, a fantastic columnist, and a great political brain, including as a loving critic of his own party, for that matter. So although we'll talk about the DA, it's going to be about politics more generally, and I hope that you will put the kettle on at 10 o'clock and make sure that you listen to every word. He is both very sharp and also very articulate. So that's coming up in the second hour of today's show. But we start the show, as always, with an open line. You can set the agenda on 011-883-0702.
702. Open line.
Before we do so, I mean, there's small little items in the news cycle that you go, I blinked and I've missed what's going on here. And I just can't seem to get a grip on it. One of those stories appear, it's for me at least, to be lawfare between the Public Protector's Office and Minister Pravin Gordhan. And you can be forgiven as a political animal, but a non-legal expert, to go, what is going on here? And what exactly is the Public Protector's Office wanting him to account for? And is he just being a diva, not wanting to subject himself, as he should, committed to the rule of law, to her authority, and more importantly, the authority of the Office of the Public Protector, regardless who the current occupant is? What is going on? And I hope that two interviews will help us to just be able to cut through some of that confusion and see whether you and I, after 10 minutes, can be a little bit clearer. The first person I want to speak to in that regard is the head of communications in the Office of the Public Protector, Opa Sekhwalwe. Opa, good morning, and thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me, sir.
I'm going to ask you very basic questions, because although many of most of my listeners are sharp, if as a political analyst and as a undergrad law student I am confused, I think many people will be confused. So the first thing I want to start off with, I've got a document in front of me, which is the complaint of one Mr. Floyd Chivambu and Anonymous against the South African Revenue Services, right? And the first question that comes to my mind, just as Joe Soap, is who is Anonymous?
Well, from time to time, you said, yes, we get complaints from people who wishes to have their identity hidden because they fear that, you know, there might be a backlash or something like that. It's similar to what you have in newspapers when you have an unnamed source. And we accept that because we think it is important to protect whistleblowers because we think they are very critical for, in the fight against wrongdoing in state affairs and elsewhere. So from time to time, we will get that. And then we do encourage people whenever we do roadshows to say, if you have come across any sort of wrongdoing that falls within the jurisdiction of the public protector, you are most welcome to bring that information to our attention. And if you fear that there may be repercussions for you if you come out in the open and report, you are welcome to, you know, report such incidences under the condition of or on condition of anonymity.
How do you assess whether their request for anonymity should be granted?
Well, we look at first and foremost the issue at hand. What are you bringing to the table? And one of the things that we also emphasize is that even if you are going to be anonymous, please reveal your identity to us at least. But if you are still not comfortable, it's fine, but at least give us an avenue to which we can communicate with you, because sometimes you get a vague complaint, and when the anonymous complainant is unreachable, we end up closing the file because we have no way of engaging with them to establish exactly what is it that they meant. So all the incoming complaints are subjected to a standard process of assessment, where we look at whether or not we have jurisdiction first, and second, we look at the merits of the complaint, whether or not it's something worth pursuing and so forth. And where we are not sure, we embark in what we call a preliminary investigation, which essentially is about ascertaining whether or not we should launch a full-scale investigation.
Okay, but I want to separate the question of the merits, I'll come to that in a second,
yeah,
from the question of having been granted anonymity in this particular case. Is this someone who currently is employed by the state? Is that the basis on which they perceive a potential backlash if their name were to be public? And is it one person or a choir of people?
In this case, it is one person. And then as far as we understand it, the person works for the government. And so they were of the view that it would be best if their identity is hidden. Because they
as far as you know, or is that established? Because if it's false, presumably their right to anonymity would not be granted.
It is established.
Were they working in concert with Floyd Chivambu, or did you guys ask them to have a meeting of the minds because they had lodged separate complaints that, purely coincidentally, were substantively the same?
No. Let me draw a distinction between the two issues. There is an aspect of, okay, let me put it this way. There's an investigation relating to the so-called rogue unit. And that's where Mr. Chivambu's complaint arises from. And then there's another one relating to, you know, the retirement and subsequent re-employment of Mr. Ivan Pillay. That one is separate, even though Mr. Chivambu also refers to it in his own complaint. And that particular complaint came from anonymous.
Okay, let's get on to the merits of the matter that, or the series of issues that Pravin Gordhan needs to respond to. The correspondence between the lawyers in their camp and the Office of the Public Protector really has one major premise as its beef with the Office of the Public Protector. And the key part of it, dated 16th of April from Malachi Kanyane Incorporated, is, as you know, that the issues that are the substantive issues that Mr. Gordhan has to respond to have already in other legal fora been dealt with and settled. Whether we talk about the Director for Special Criminal Investigations, as you know, that settled this issue in 2016 by declining to prosecute charges relating to materially the same complaints, as you know, OPA. Whether we talk about the Nugent Commission of Inquiry and that report to the President on the 11th of December, which also found no wrongdoing on the part of SARS and the Minister in particular in relation to substantially similar allegations. So here's the question then that the public and I want to know an answer to. If other very important, respected legal and constitutional fora have dealt with this issue and your office is incredibly busy, why do you want to re-rake the matter?
Let's start with the reference to the NPA. We have been explaining now and again that the public protector's mandate is maladministration, which you could call administrative wrongs or lapses in the administration. Whereas the NPA would have pursued a criminal matter. So we want people to be able to draw a distinction between the two, that it is possible for a criminal matter to have a life of its own, an administrative investigation. An example that I've made time and again is that, for example, tomorrow the public protector will be in Vrede in the Free State pursuing the Estina matter. She will be interacting with beneficiaries or people who are supposed to be beneficiaries in that particular project. And then shortly after that, she will line interviews and may subpoena politicians who are implicated in that matter. The NPA, on the other hand, dropped its case on the Estina case last year. But that decision of the NPA, because it was criminal, it has not impacted our own investigation here, which is continuing. So people need to be able to draw a distinction between the two. The one is criminal, the other is just maladministration.
I totally get that. So just in terms of the source of law, which particular clauses and aspect of the Public Protector Act are you therefore relying on here, just so that we have it on record and distinguish it from the sui generis criminal investigations that can happen elsewhere in the legal system? Exactly where in the Public Protector are we drawing this from? Because when I shortly speak to the attorney for the minister, I want him to be able to answer to this, because they keep making this argument that you are dealing with now. And by the way, I think you're persuasive on the point that the matter has been dealt with elsewhere. Just to be plain to the public, what source of law are you relying on here that is unique to the Public Protector? And I've got nothing to do with the Hawks or with the Nugent Commission.
The Public Protector Act, it's a pity I haven't got the copy of that law here, but the Public Protector Act itself makes it clear that the Public Protector's role is primarily maladministration. Things like abuse of power, abuse of state resources, improper enrichment, discourteous conduct between on the part of public officials with when they interact with members of the public. So it stipulates a range of those issues that constitute maladministration as opposed to criminal conduct.
Mm.
And then where the public, it further goes to say, where the public protector, as part of an investigation, comes across criminal conduct or evidence of criminal conduct, she must then defer to appropriate or competent bodies. That is why from time to time when you read our report, you will see in the remedial action where we came across evidence of criminal conduct, we would refer to the Hawks to say, take it
sure.
up, open a docket and then hand over to the NPA. Mm.
Second last question to you. I have had a look at the Public Protector Act. I just don't want to put words in your mouth. I think you are chiefly relying on probably Section 11 in particular. But I want to talk about a different part of the Public Protector Act. Section 6, subsection 9, requires that where a matter that you are looking at originates in an event that is 2 years or older in terms of the date of occurrence of the particular incident that you are looking at, that you better have, quote-unquote, special circumstances to justify conducting that investigation. Now, I want to know, can you explain very simply, not in legalese, in plain English to the public, what are special circumstances at the level of generality? And then be very precise, what are the special circumstances in relation to Pravin Gordhan to justify departing from this ordinary requirement that you deal with issues that are not quite that far back in history?
Yes. First and foremost, that is a discretionary power that the Public Protector has.
But it's still subject to the legal requirement of rationality, so you have to explain it.
Yes. Now, in the case at hand, and before I get to that, let me say that the special circumstances depends on the merits of each case. Now, in the case at hand, the Public Protector has explained to the minister that she considered these special circumstances, and then for her, she had to look at the nature of the complaint at hand, first and foremost. Does it warrant an investigation that goes back 10 years? She had to look at the seriousness of the allegations that have been leveled against the minister. And then she had to look at whether the outcome or the potential outcome of her investigation could rectify the alleged systemic problems in this matter. She also had to look at whether she would be able to successfully investigate the matter, having considered the fact that evidence or records may not be available because of the fact that this matter took place, or the events being investigated took place a decade or so ago. And then she had to look at whether there are any competent alternative remedies available to the complainant.
Potentially.
And the overall impact of the investigation. And then having considered all of those, the public protector then decided to pursue the matter.
Okay. So,
and another point to make is whether she had to consider whether her refusal to investigate would perpetuate the alleged violations of the law as contained in the complaint.
A final question, and my last question meshes nicely with this letter answer that you've just given, Opa. It's a generally fascinating issue at the intersection of law and politics, however, because, funny enough, the same discretion that you're talking about that she has to exercise, and if we don't have faith in her, then we should obviously impeach her. But once we have her in office, we have to leave her alone to make a judgment call, and that will happen to many people who are Chapter 9 oversight heads. But here's the thing. The same set of facts could easily have led to the opposite judgment call. In other words, she could have said to herself, sure, the gravity of the allegations by Floyd Chivambu and Anonymous are gigantic. However, as the PP, I've got incredible faith that not one, not two, but three different other constitutional fora have already ventilated the matter. So despite the gravity of the claims by Anonymous and Floyd, I nevertheless am satisfied that it is an appropriate exercise of my discretion, particularly given that I have, infamously, limited resources in my office to not go ahead with this matter. What would have been wrong with that reasoning?
Well, you know, people keep referring to the other competent bodies that dealt with the matter. We've already disposed of the NPA matter. Let's deal with the Nugent Commission. When you read the terms of reference for the commission, you will see that it is confined to a certain period in time, specifically the time when the former SARS head, Mr. Moyane, was in charge. But because one of the witnesses who had to testify there insisted on talking about this, that's when the matter came to the fore at the commission. So it was never really part of the scope of work of the commission. But be that as it may, the judge did deal with that matter in his report. And people tend to quote it selectively to say that he found nothing wrong with that. But he also said something else to say, for example, and I'm quoting verbatim here, that members of the unit might at times have acted unlawfully, that SARS employment policies might have been breached, that members might unlawfully have acquired and used equipment, and this would be surveillance equipment, all of which came later or to be alleged. I see no reason SARS was or is not entitled to establish that kind of unit. So essentially, our focus looks at this alleged unlawful conduct that the equipment was acquired and people's conversations, private conversations were being eavesdropped on and so forth. And so the public protector felt that she has to pursue this particular matter to settle it once and for all. And there are other competent investigative bodies that arrived at different conclusions to the ones you are referring to.
Opa, thank you for being detailed and coming on. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, sir.
That was Opa Segalwe, the head of communications in the Office of the Public Protector. We'll take a break. On the other side of this, I'm going to ask Teboho Malatshe, the attorney for Minister Pravin Gordhan, to tell me which part of Opa's reasoning he finds legally not quite to be as compelling as it sounds. Okay, joining me now is the attorney from the Minister of Pravin Gordhan, Teboho Malatshe. Teboho, you heard my engagement with the Office of the Public Protector. As far as I can read your correspondence, you are the legal expert, not me. But it seems to me as a layperson that your chief concern, while you've got many, but really the most important one is that there are other legal fora in which this matter or the more substantive claims have been dealt with before. But Opa is right, isn't he? That even if that is true, there are unique powers and interests that inhere in the Office of the Public Protector through the Public Protector Act, which goes to the heart of maladministration. And those are a very different set of concerns to the concerns before a judge or even a commission of inquiry.
Morning to you and your listeners. I think that is where we part ways with the Office of the Public Protector. And it is simply this. If you look at their own competencies under Section 6.4. Yes, they look at maladministration, abuse and exercise in exercise of power. They look at improper, dishonest act, incidentally, contemplated under the Prevention and Combating of Corrupt Activities Act. They look at improper and unlawful enrichment, and they look at any act or omission by a person in the employment of government at any level. Now, I must tell you that all of those constitute a crime in one form, shape, or another. If the set of facts are put before the Hawks and later considered by the NPA, and it is found that those facts don't constitute a crime, that these, which I've just set out to you, which relate to the Public Protector's Office, have a lesser level of proof than that which is required to prosecute a case in a criminal context. So we're not looking at different facts. We're not applying different laws. We're applying the same laws to the same set of facts. And we say that in that context, it doesn't make sense that there would still be consideration for this complaint to be investigated.
Tabogo, can I engage you on that point? That point is legally inaccurate. The same set of facts or alleged facts have different sources of law that are being applied to them. So when Shaun the Sheep goes in front of the public and pretends that there's a case for Minister Gordhan to answer, and then 3 weeks later he has to eat his proverbial hat, his concerns as erstwhile head of the NPA are very different to a public protector that says the very reason why the Chapter 9 institution was conceived of in the first place by the founding fathers and mothers of our constitution was precisely for me to have a different kind of look to the kind of look that the criminal justice system might have when it is being asked to look into whether it be a rogue unit or some other alleged criminal action. And therefore, the sources of law have a different object. And I'll give you a practical example of the difference. Theoretically, we'll get to motive later. It is possible, for example, as you know, for the public protector to end up saying, you know what, here is how I think, as a matter of good administration, not criminal law, administrative law, here's how I think is the best way for us to use public money prudently when it comes to early retirements, and for any commissioner, deputy commissioner, or minister to never ever have a cloud over their head, I recommend the following remedial action for how to set up some really awesome principles that will increase the levels of transparency in terms of good public administration. A court of law isn't interested with that kind of remedy, and therefore, to bring it back to your argument, it is not true that the Public Protector Act has got the same set of concerns identical as that of a court of law.
Well, if you...
Do you agree with me?
I wasn't no, I don't. Let me be more articulate than I was the last time. It can only be maladministration if it offends a set of laws. It cannot be otherwise, because the measure of whether it's maladministration or not, it's a set of facts apply to a set of laws. In our case, if we and I'm not suggesting, by the way, that it's my proposition is a general one. I'm just saying
I don't disagree with that point. The only point that I'm making, which is incredibly minor, I didn't think you would disagree with it, is that some maladministration is not criminal behavior. Do you agree?
Well, that's correct. But let's go back to the facts in this case. The facts in this case is Minister Gordhan participated in the establishment of a high-risk investigation unit targeting the illicit economy. Now, the facts are common cause. They're in the public domain. The law is there. And what we are saying is, hang on, if you were to investigate the very same complaint considered by your predecessor, the NPA, applying, by the way, all of them, and the Nugent Commission, the same set of facts and the same laws, because we don't have a different set of facts. We don't. We don't have a different laws applicable to determine whether there's maladministration, abuse in exercise of power under the Public Protector Act. We're not applying different laws.
Okay, just hold that thought for me, Tebogo. I'm just going to spend two more minutes with you, and then we're going to leave it there for today. But I do want to just get some clarity on your latter point. I mean, because if your argument is true, the public protector's office may as well not exist. So I think you're being disingenuous here about the specific and the unique authority of the public protector's office, whatever we think about the current office holder. Tebogo, I don't want to keep you longer than we had agreed on, but I do appreciate you being present because this is of profound national interest. But here's where I mean, a lot, look, Pravin Gordhan divides the public and people come to this issue depending on how they feel about the man. I'm trying to be dispassionate and separate the politics out from the law. But where your legal argument to me doesn't entirely make sense, even though my instinct is to believe you, is that if your reasoning is correct, then really what it amounts to, let's be blunt about it, is that the public protector may as well just be deferential to the outcomes of court processes. But you know that when we designed the public protector's office, like an ombud in Western Europe, we intended her to be capable of making all sorts of findings and recommendations that have a different kind of objective to what happens in a court of law, even if there's interesting overlap in some of the aspects of the legal processes. Surely you accept that?
I do, but I think we're probably at cross purposes on this. Remember, the context within which we raise this issue is this, that if you must measure the same facts and measure the same law applicable in our case, right? We're not generalistic in our approach. In our case, there must be a consideration under the context of whether do I consider there to be special circumstances to investigate this matter.
Okay.
I must have regard to what other bodies have done. And it is in that context that we raise the issue that says, hang on, facts, common cause.
Yes.
We're looking at the same legal principles. Therefore, if three other authorities have arrived at the same conclusion, what is this fourth investigation about?
I asked OPA that question. What did you make of his justification?
Arrived at the same conclusion. Sorry?
Okay, but I put that question to OPA because that's been bugging me with how the public protectors handle this matter. And as sharp as I am feeling this morning, I have to confess that I couldn't overreach in my questions to OPA because I thought that OPA was being quite fair. I mean, we can speculate on political and other motive going on here in the public protector's office, but on the law, I thought he did a decent job to distinguish those other processes. He talked, for example, about how the Nugent Commission is cited, but often the details of the remarks that came out of that report are not looked at in detail, and it differs in scope from what is before the public protectors in relation to the complaint from Anonymous and from Floyd Chivambu, and also that the gravity of the potential allegations against Minister Pravin Gordhan are such that you can't ignore them. What did you make of Tebogo? What did you make of OPA when he tried to justify a few minutes ago what is so special about these circumstances? Did you find him compelling?
Two things. Firstly, if you've asked him very, very interestingly, the general grounds, he set them out very well. Did you hear him speaking about specific circumstances, special circumstances in relation to this case? Not. I didn't hear that. Now, what we're questioning is, if there are no such special circumstances as prescribed by the very act that applies to the office, we've got cause to ask, why are you investigating this, which is 2007 old and has been broached by other authorities? We've asked that question. We're waiting for an answer.
Okay.
The general grounds are not sufficient. Secondly, and most importantly, Minister doesn't say that the office mustn't investigate. That we must all understand. He says she must do a job. It's a constitutional duty to do a job. And nobody, including you in the media space, must prevent her from doing a job on the premise of some allegations or some inferences or improper motive. We have no facts to suggest that. All we're saying is when you do, please advise us. A, what are the special considerations applicable to it? And B, why must we go through a process we've gone through three times over, including her own office?
Okay.
And that's all we say.
Last,
I'm not saying she should.
I hear you, yeah. Last question, Tebogo. Keep the answer to me under a minute, if possible. OPA, who is now gone, I think would say he answered the particularity of what is special about the Pravin Gordhan case and the two-year-plus time lapse by reference to the nature of the allegations against him. Do you accept that as a justification and explanation for what is special? And if you don't, can you, in simple, non-legal terms, explain to the public what kind of answer from the public protector would satisfy you as being specific enough?
I would have expected them to say, this is the additional information evidence we have, which hasn't been previously considered by other authorities. We don't have that.
Okay.
Very, and as I said, facts are common cause.
Yeah.
And the law, as between all us lawyers, applicable to this set of facts is the same.
Fantastic. Teboho, thanks so much for coming on.
All right. Thank you.
I was Teboho Malatsi, the attorney for the Minister of Pravin Gordhan. Here's the thing, just a small comment from me. You know, I like law, and unfortunately, law has become a site of political contestation in this country. It's not new to our nascent society. I am making my way steadily through the book by Advocate Michelle LaRue and Judge Dennis Davis. I'll interview them within the next week or two, entitled Lawfare. And that intersection between law and politics matters enormously. You can't talk law without talking politics in this country. And we're now at a stage where you can't talk politics without being fluent in the most important aspects of the law, because the two are so enmeshed, for better or for worse. The last 30 minutes or so, I've tried to get clarity from the Public Protector's Office on the legal case that Pravin Gordhan needs to respond to. And obviously you heard his attorney responding. But I want to be speculative here, because you and I don't mince our words. I smell a rat. I think that even though I don't find Teboho convincing that the Public Protector does not have unique legal authority to investigate this matter, just because it's been settled elsewhere in the courts, doesn't mean that she can't. I think she can. But I think we've got to be honest what's going on here. The Public Protector's Office is playing politics. I really think that is simple. And we can talk legal theory seminars till the cows come home. For an office that has got limited resources to go over this stuff again and again and again, to re-rake what is no longer fertile legal ground, is enormously worrying, especially when she's already had a checkered time in office. 30702, what is on your mind? How do you see these issues playing out? And how do you feel about how much of our politics plays out along legalistic lines in the courts of law and through legal processes? One of these days, you won't be able to talk politics unless you are fluent in Latin. And that is not inherently a bad thing, because we do have a system of rule of law and constitutional supremacy, so the law matters. But it is worrying that so many common sense social and political issues often end up really in the hands of attorneys. And yes, some of my best friends are lawyers, but I really wish that we could keep some things in the public space where you and I and the politicians can just have honest debates. Honest. But as Billy Joel famously said, honesty is such a lonely word. 702. Open line. Matume, good morning.
Morning, Isibis.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, Isibis, I've been listening, and frankly, I don't buy what the spokesperson from Public Protector was saying.
As a sidebar, I must say, he's an excellent spokesperson. I wouldn't want his job, given his principle, I almost said political principle, a Freudian slip. But go ahead, Matume, what do you make of the content of what he said?
Well, according to my experience, it seems the Office of the Public Protector, they mainly focused on political-related cases. Many of us have been complaining for many months ago, and we've never received any responses. And I'm quite appalled that, they're spending so much time focused on cases which have already been exhausted in other arenas, while most of us have complained and we're not getting any service from them.
Yeah. I'm afraid I can't disagree with that. I mean, I did my best to be dispassionate, and I think I did a half-decent job. OPA's claim in theory, and it's all theoretical, and then we keep it real in terms of real politics, his theoretical claim will be that the scope of the Public Protector's work and the kinds of remedies she can potentially come up with are very different to what happens in the criminal justice system, and therefore she's not going over old stuff. She's doing what is within not just her scope, but is at the heart of her constitutional mandate. Do you not find that logic convincing?
Not at all. I can make an example. Last year in October, I made a formal complaint to the Office of the Public Protector because I felt that the traffic department is abusing its power.
Yeah.
And when I laid this complaint, explaining that when I went to renew my license, I was told that I had fines which were like 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked them, why must I pay for fines which you guys have not bothered to actually come after me? Because I was not even aware that I've got fines.
Mm.
And according to law, that after a certain time, if you guys have not followed any procedure to make sure that I do comply with any, if I have been found guilty, why now am I not going to be getting my license unless I pay those fines? I had to pay those fines, and then they allowed me to apply for a new license. So frankly, in my view, traffic department is lazy to do its job. All it does now, it is using its new system of ensuring that if anyone wants to get a new license, before they allow you to do it, you have to pay the old fines, even if they have not bothered to follow all the process to ensure that people do pay if those people are found to be guilty for whatever fines they claimed they were held. When I complained to the Office of the Director, nobody has bothered to come back to me because I told them, look, these people have not followed any procedure to ensure that I'm aware of such fines, and they've pursued me to ensure that I do pay if I'm found guilty. But now I'm having to be forced to pay for fines which, according to me, are 4 years old. But now at the end, I'm paying them because I need to get this new license. So this Office of the Public is not doing anything about it, but it's busy focusing on Praveen Godan.
I hear you, Matume. The point is well taken. Manekshi, good morning.
Hello, good morning, your feelings. My point is just a small point. In the conversation that you had with Obafikhawe and the other lawyer, Malachi, the point wasn't clearly made that even if the public protector does look at a very different set of issues, which is related to governance and administration, we must not forget that the previous public protector under Advocate Tuli Modonsela did examine the same case, and she found no wrongdoing. So the fact of the matter is, if the public protector's office looks at a different perspective on the issue, then the public protector herself did examine this issue already.
Yeah, no, I'm aware of that. Yeah, what the problem, as Teboho rightly pointed out, Praveen Gordhan's lawyer, and I think in the end maybe he wins this point. You're right, Manekshi, is that if she's going to, as in a court of law, if we take the analogy, if you are going to re-examine something your own office had already established a set of views on, then you better have new evidence that have come to light. But then you need to be very clear about the particularities of those, and this hasn't been the case in this instance.
Correct. And then in the Public Protectors Act, it says that if you are going to reopen this investigation, you have to say exactly what is the new circumstances for why you are reopening this
100%.
Investigation. And that is not clear. That is not at all clear. Nobody's answering that question. And the reason why they're not answering that question, and unfortunately, you know, it goes into a very messy state capture battle because the public protector seems to have some kind of, she's been privy to an intelligence report, which she should not have been privy to. And I think that's where this whole thing becomes very messy.
And that report goes to the heart of the matter, absolutely.
You know, they're not, and that is why they're reluctant to say what is the new circumstance.
Absolutely. 110%. Manekshi, I think you are bang on the money.
Thank you.
You want to take over the mic?
No, I think you do a wonderful job.
Honestly, the last 2 minutes of comment from you, absolutely the perfect way to take this matter forward. She needs to tell us what is different in the facts since 2014. And in addition to that, that attachment to what had been submitted from Anonymous. 702 Open Line. Still coming up on the show, in the next hour, I'll be engaging Tony Leon on electoral politics along the way. I'll ask him to make the case for voting Democratic Alliance. Maybe Peter Bruce, if you're listening, maybe you want to listen and see whether you find Tony compelling on this particular issue. I look forward to it. Always enjoy engaging Tony. Rob, good morning. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Dr. Sebius.
I'm not a doctor, but thanks for the preemptive honor if I get there one day. What is on your mind, Dr. Rob?
Okay. I wanted to say, I think I agree with your comments that the public prosecutor, there is something fishy behind the scenes. I think she is being used by some politicians, and she has lots of issues that she can concentrate on, which are really gravy. Like dealing with the Bosasa, just investigate the Bosasa contracts with the government, the Estina Dairy Farm, even dealing with the VBS, the municipalities that were investing money despite the advice that they shouldn't do so. And she is really, really sticking on to wanting to just harass Pravin Gordhan. I think she's being used.
Yeah, and I mean, obviously some of this stuff goes to motive and being speculative, but you know what? Let's be honest. We don't just opine when there's scientific evidence. We look at someone's time in office, whether we have faith in them, etc. And, I struggle. I really, really struggle to readjust my impressions of the current, office holder of the Public Protector's Office. Thanks, Rob, for calling in. Tony, good morning. Welcome to the show.
You serious? I think the Public Protectors Act is a new legislation, and it's a new innovation in the whole democratic situation that we have. So the phrase special circumstances or whatever has not been crystallized in our courts. The courts hasn't had the opportunity to define that. And so it is easy legally to hide behind that, to try and, basically say that special could mean special circumstances could mean anything.
I agree. Or that the gravity of the alleged wrongdoing settles the requirement of special.
Of course.
Which is too easy.
So it's too easy, yes. So the public protector's reputation has been tainted. Her bona fides are questionable. And we cannot exclude that there is some political influence in this particular matter.
I suppose, yeah, I mean, I'm trying very hard, as you can see, and failing to play devil's advocate because I agree with you substantially. But she might say, okay, but on the other hand, if an opposition party MP comes to me and I don't take an allegation from them seriously, I will also have a perception problem that people might think that I'm being deferential to the government of the day because Pravin Gordhan has got enormous political power. How would you respond to that? I mean, you can see I'm clutching at straws here. But if she were to say that, what would you say, Tony?
Well, I would say that she is a creature of law. The public protector is a creature of law. She is established, her powers are established in terms of a particular statute. So it would be right within her powers to say that I'm not going along with that. This is what the law states. If you have a problem with that, go to court and let the court adjudicate on what special circumstances mean and then come back.
Yeah.
And then it's not her job to try and accommodate the different political parties and political opinions.
110%. Couldn't agree with you more. Thanks, Tony. Excellent contribution. Thanks for calling in.